Debbie Fields Buck was born and mostly raised in the western panhandle of Texas. She currently resides in Altus, Oklahoma, with her husband, Dave. Dave, where are you at? Right in front. Very good. In the early part of 1994, Debbie began having a series of coincidental encounters with the Lord, culminating in a prayer session in November, where Father guided her to 2 Chronicles 7:14 and said, "You are going to tell them." For 18 long years, he took her through a wilderness kind of experience with little evidence of what he meant by what he said. In the spring of 2012, a few months after she had stumbled upon Jonathan Cahn's book, The Harbinger, she knew that the book was not simply a parallel to ancient Israel, but that America was, in fact, Israel today. He began showing her clues and proofs of the pattern of the tabernacle in the wilderness laid out in the geography, national resources, and landmarks in the United States. Father directed her to attend the Fall Stone Kingdom meeting in St. Louis in 2012, where she met Lauren Smoot, David Joseph Staton, Rick Brand, and a few others on the Sunday evening after the conference was over. She shared a few of the specifics of what she had learned. They invited her on the spot to come to Dallas and speak at the November Lone Star Conference, where she first presented, "The Tabernacle is in Us." Time permitting, she will also share some current event details regarding Isaiah 45, 2 Kings 9 and 10, and our current president. Without further ado, let us welcome Debbie Fields Buck.
Today. that's where we are right now. You know that, right? The dry bones are coming alive. What James didn't tell you, and he didn't know about this, was when I left out of the church in Dallas, when I got through doing this the first time, I walked out the front door and over to the left-hand side, and there was a sign, and I had been asking God for a sign. Am I in the right place at the right time, doing what I'm supposed to be doing? And there's the picture of the sign, and it says 2 Chronicles 7:14, and I was looking at it just dumbfounded, and he goes, "Here's your sign." I mean, tied it up with a bow. I was where I was supposed to be, and that's one of those rare times when you know that you're doing what you're supposed to be doing when you're supposed to be doing it. Okay, there is a lot of stuff to cover in here. Basically, James set the stage for us earlier. What he said was that America is, in time Israel, the regathering place. And he has given us a lot of historical proofs, but I'm going to show you with stuff you can put your hands on that this is true. Okay, we go to the next slide now. His tent really is in us, U.S. us. And what started me off on this journey was in late September of 2011, I ran across the Harbinger book by Jonathan Cahn. And I had actually seen some videos prior to that, but he kept talking about Isaiah 9:10. And Isaiah 9:10 says that the bricks have fallen down, but we will be rebuild with hewn stone. The sycamores are felled, but we will change them into cedars. And he just kept on with that verse, and I thought, okay, all of this stuff that he's talking about, is everybody familiar with the Harbinger here? Or at least part of the story? If you're not, you need to read this because it's really important as to what's going on in the world in the last 15 years. There's also a follow-up book called The Paradigm that talks about what's happening right now. But it will give you some explanation about what happened when the towers fell and subsequent events about the tree that was in St. Paul's Cathedral and things like that. You need to kind of familiarize yourself with that because those are things that happened once before long ago in ancient Israel, and they literally have happened here on American soil in the years from 2001 on forward. Okay? God's judgment was on the old ancient Israel kingdom for idolatry and rebellion. This is a repeat. History repeats itself. Ecclesiastes 3 tells us that history repeats itself. Okay, now we're going to go back a couple of verses and find out what he missed. Okay? Do you see that? The Lord sent a word into Jacob. It has lighted upon Israel, and all the people shall know, even Ephraim and the inhabitants of Samaria, that say in the pride and stoutness of heart, the bricks are fallen down, but we will build with hewn stone. The sycamores are cut down. We will change them into cedars. What you see is a progression with the names. You see Jacob, Israel, Ephraim, and Samaria. You see those names. You don't see the name Manasseh. You don't see the name Judah. You see Jacob, Israel, Ephraim, and Samaria. And there is a reason for that. Back a long time ago, that was the progression of the stages that Israel went through. Jacob started out being Jacob, the deceiver, the trickster, and all of this. And then after he wrestled with God, he turned into Israel. Then, as the idolatry came, and Ephraim, the grandson of Jacob, started kind of falling this direction, and then later on down into Samaria, where you have just totally fallen into near depravity. So that was the first progression. But those are the names that we're looking at here, is also the leaders of the tribe. Okay? This map right here that James has shown us, I want everybody to have time to have a look, and we'll probably put it up somewhere over here later on during the conference so you can have a close look at it. You can't see from here what we're looking at, but all of those little names on this map are Bible names of every place in the United States that has been named after a biblical town, or biblical names of people, or other things like that. That it's full of biblical names. Okay, either the Bible is true and believable and correct, or it isn't. There's no mention of any other tribes. Ephraim is the leader of the 10-tribe house of Joseph. The connection to the U.S. is right here. We'll look at some other unrelated stuff towards the end, but right now we're going to make our case for America as the tent or the tabernacle of God. Okay, I'm on slide 6, Rob. I originally saw the bones of this on this website called 3max.org. I'm trying to give credit where credit is due. There was some initial stuff laid out about the 13s that are in American symbolism, this great seal of the United States, how that Washington, D.C. is laid out and things like that. There was some rudimentary stuff in there to start with. But I looked at it and I thought, there's got to be more detail in there. And there was. And I later found out that Perry Stone had done some similar work about this. And I tried to call their office, but I'm a little nobody from nowhere. And you can't get to Perry Stone from here. So I'm giving credit where credit is due. I'm glad that they put a foundation under me for this so that we can move on and see some real detail in this stuff. Now, all of this started on 9/11, 2001. That was when the first attack on America took place. But we're going to look, and Rob, I'm on slide 70 here. Slide 7, I'm sorry. We're going to look at the gematria for 9/11. All of those words right there have a gematria of 9/11. Beginning, grace, remnant, apostles, foundations of heaven, and the beginning of wisdom. All of those things are 9/11. So who and where is God's tabernacle today? Now, did you know that the entrance curtains for the tabernacle were red, white, and blue? Now, I haven't read this book, but that's the best image of the curtains that I could find on there, because you can see them both in the outer court entrance and the entrance to the holy place. Now, this next slide, this is the layout of the tribes camped around the tabernacle in four divisions, plus the Levites in the center. Just note that Judah is the leading tribe on the east, and New York and the Florida populations have the largest concentration of those that we call Jewish. Now, Zebulun has also been identified with the Dutch. What is now in the New Jersey area was actually called New Amsterdam at the beginning. And the Dutch were settling in the east and northeast in the early days. Reuben leads on the south. It's almost universally thought by the Anglo-Saxon Israelite believers to be those from France and the surrounding countries. Ephraim leads in the west and as an idolatrous person that is, Ephraim is the one. You don't get any more starstruck and idol-struck than you do in California. Now, Dan leads in the north with Asher and Naphtali, the representative of the northern European countries, the Swedish, the Denmark, Norway, Finns, all of the Nordic people seem to have conglomerated around Minnesota and Wisconsin and the northern states and up in Michigan as well. The Levite priest camped in the center of the tabernacle, and if you've ever heard of the Bible Belt, that looks just about right. Okay, this is a basic diagram of the layout of the tabernacle with its furnishings. There's two pieces in the outer court on the east end, three pieces in the middle, one piece in the inner third chamber on the west. Okay, and we're going to turn it around here and lay it out like this. Now, as you can see, one will enter the tabernacle at the eastern gate. You come to the place of the brazen altar. Just beyond this is the brazen laver. And then you're going to enter into the holy place. On the left, south side, you have the golden lampstand. On the right, north side, the table of showbread. Just beyond this is the golden altar of incense. It sits right up against the veil that separates the Holy of Holies, in which rests the Ark of the Covenant. The mercy seat has two covering cherubim on each end, and inside the ark are Aaron's rod, the golden pot of manna, and the tables of stone on which are written the Ten Commandments. Did that not click through? Well, yeah, close enough. Okay. Now, the area on the east coast, I'm on 12 now. Okay, the area on the east was the first opening of this country from other nations, from North Carolina to Massachusetts. Now, this was the opening gate from which our country was first approached by the early Western European immigrants wishing to settle here. Later on, Ellis Island between New York and New Jersey was the focal point of processing new immigrants. Ron has pointed out that Father's hooked on phonics and plays on words, so he can be very punny when it suits him. So we have the New York, the Empire State, with its state motto Excelsior, or ever upward. And New Jersey is the Garden State, with its motto Liberty and Prosperity. That makes it clear it's not simply a coincidence or two. So you have the New Ark and the Garden State in New York. Now, Roanoke Island in North Carolina was actually the first landing and the first official colony that was located in this new land for Israel by Sir Walter Raleigh in 1585. Now, this particular colony did not make it, as often referred to as the Lost Colony. It disappeared after their leader returned to England for fresh supplies. North Carolina's motto is Esse Quam Videri in Latin. That means to be rather than to seem. Now, the choice for this motto is a hidden clue to establish the fact that the USA is not only supposed to seem like Israel, but actually is Israel. The first landing of American Israelites in North Carolina is the equivalent of the 12 spies sent out to scope the land, and I will tell you why in just a moment. We've got this slide first. We're going to show you some things here. Why is my slide not going where it needs to go? Okay, there we are. My notes did not transfer over. Why didn't they transfer over? Okay. Anyway, I did scroll down in this, not there. The whole thing is missing. Okay. On the brown over here, that is the area where you have the Blue Ridge and the Smoky Mountains. And then you have got the Brazen Laver area, the river of the Holy Spirit. And the reason that the Holy Spirit River looks like that is because in the directions for building all of this stuff, all of the other things had measurements. Measure it this long by this deep and do it this way. He just said, build a laver and fill it full of water, which is basically exactly what he did right here. Okay, then the arch comes in, which is the Gateway Arch in Missouri. It's called the Gateway to the West. Okay, there is your lampstand. It had to have oil, and Texas and Oklahoma have got the oil. The next one is the Table of Showbread. Where is our breadbasket of America? Right there. And it is flat, like a table for the showbread. Okay? Then you've got the altar of incense. It has to sit in a yellow stone. Well, it does. It had to sit in a yellow stone. And then we've got this veil of the Rocky Mountains and Purple Mountains. Majesty is not just a line in a song. After that, there we have the Ark of the Covenant. And it's got two cherubims on each side. And I will show you where those are in just a moment. I do not know why my notes didn't transfer over. Now, in North Carolina, when they first got here, they found huge grapes when they got here. They're called scuppernongs or some variation of that word, and they're basically great white grapes. There's also purple ones called muscadines. The name comes from the Scuppernong River in North Carolina, mainly along the coastal plain. It's first mentioned as a white grape in a written log book by the Florentine explorer Giovanni de Verrazzano. He was exploring the area of the Cape Fear River Valley in 1524, and he wrote, "Many vines growing naturally there." Sir Walter Raleigh's explorers, the captains Philip Amadas and Arthur Barlow, wrote in 1584 that North Carolina's coast was, quote, so full of grapes as the very beating and surge of the sea overflowed them. In all the world, the like abundance is not to be found. In 1585, Governor Ralph Lane, when describing North Carolina to Raleigh, stated, "We have discovered the main to be the goodliest soil under the cope of heaven, so abounding with sweet trees that bring rich and pleasant grapes of such greatness, yet wild, as France and Spain nor Italy hath no greater." There is a vine that is supposed to be the oldest cultivated grapevine in the world. It is a 400-year-old scuppernong mother vine growing on Roanoke Island in North Carolina. So, what did they find first when they went over to scope out the Promised Land? Yep. Much grapes. And so, in the fall of 2014, after I had already done this twice, and I was still locating new information all the time, Father woke me up one night, and I mean, it was dark 30. I don't know why he wakes me up in the middle of the night unless that's just because I'm asleep and I'm shutting up. So anyway, he said, go look up North Carolina and honey. So I did. I typed that exact phrase into the goggles. And I found this picture on the very first page in the second listing. It says, the mystery of the blue honey. Are you kidding me? Blue honey? So, let me tell you that the second thing that I found was the state insect of North Carolina is the honeybee. So I thought to myself, self, you need some of that honey, but apparently it's not as easy to come by as you would imagine. Anyway, there's this big long story about how it turns the honey blue, and it's some kind of reaction that goes on in the bees after they go back to the hive, and occasionally, the aluminum content apparently in the soil that grows the plants will have a reaction with the bee's honey stomach, and it will actually turn the stuff blue. And this is what's left of a 4-ounce jar. By the time that I got it, it ended up to be $50 with shipping, so there was not a whole lot left. But anyway, this is some of the blue honey right here. So we have grapes, and we have bees and honey. And then I'm on 18. Now, since North Carolina's state motto is esse quam videri, to be rather than to seem, this is a good clue. It's the first part of the nation to be actively explored and scoped out. Grapes, honey. So what do you suppose is probably the state beverage? Yep. Got milk? Now, I'm going to go back to the tabernacle design again here. The Blue Ridge and the Smoky Mountains run across the eastern perimeter, and here is where an abundance of coal is found and mined in America. Coals are needed for the brazen altar where the animal sacrifices were killed and grilled. I'm thinking that the Israelites must have been the original barbecue kings. Okay, I mean, tell me I'm wrong. Additionally, from a symbolic level, many battles were fought in this region during the Revolutionary War and also the uncivil war between the states, resulting in many lives sacrificed in that area of the country over and over and over again. Consequently, also many of the first revival fires began in this area. Now, this next picture is one that I actually took when I went up to go visit James, and you can see that the way that the clouds are in there, it looks like smoke comes off of them. So that's the Smoky Mountains with coals in them. Now, the brazen altar and the brazen laver were made from brass, and brass is an alloy metal that has copper at its base. As far back as the time of Joseph, there were mysterious signs of Michigan copper being mined by the tons by a mysterious people who dug the copper out and apparently shipped it out to other lands. We're talking like millions of tons. They've seen the evidence of the stuff being mined, but they don't know who these people were. We don't have time to cover that in any detail, but the material for both the altar and the laver is here in vast quantities. Now, the brazen laver is the Mississippi River of the Holy Spirit. The Indians had called it the River de Esperanto or whatever for a long time. And you can see all of the other rivers that feed into it. So it's not just the Mississippi River. You've got a whole network of rivers flowing into that. That's a big labor. And like I said, Exodus 30:17, the Lord spake unto Moses and said, thou shalt also make a laver of brass, and his foot also of brass, to wash withal, and thou shalt put it between the tabernacle of the congregation and the altar, and thou shalt put water therein. That's it. That was the only instructions. The Gateway Arch of St. Louis is big and silver and called the Gateway to the West, and silver is all about redemption, remember? Okay? It sits right to the west of the Mississippi River in St. Louis. It's centered pretty well right in the midst of the American Tabernacle. So what's next? There are three things located here in this area. And on the south side is the lampstand, and to the north is the table of showbread, and we'll look at the lampstand on the south. Now, this next picture is just a map that shows you, just in the state of Oklahoma, the oil and gas reserves. And here are some pump jacks in an area of Texas where they're just lined up next to each other, one after the other. There is oil in them bar hills. And you must have oil for the lamps. Now, like I said, the table is showbread. You've got cans of sweet fields right there. And there is no doubt where the bread basket is. I did have a hard time finding the altar of incense first, because according to other people, they're talking about Colorado is the red state and there's spices there. And yes, there is. And that Colorado and Wyoming connect there together. But it took me a little while to figure out about Old Faithful as a type of the altar, mostly because it's off-centered. It's not centered exactly where it needs to be. And I looked at it, and I actually found one place that actually has a full-scale model that you can walk through. I think it's somewhere in Arkansas. And you can walk through it. And they actually had theirs off to the center, up closer to the table of showbread. And apparently you have to zigzag through the curtains for the priest to get back into the Holy of Holies. Now, one other thing is that there should be some indication that the Holy Spirit would be in this place. And it turns around and there is actually a town named Casper. And I think Casper is probably a friendly ghost. It turns out that Casper is actually an old Persian name that means treasurer or treasure giver. You can't make this stuff up. This also sits in the Shoshone National Forest nearby, and that word is derived from Shushan or Susa, which is also a Persian word meaning lily or trumpet because of the shape. So I would suspect that that's not a mistake. Now, we acquired our double portion of land from France in 1803 in the Louisiana Purchase. Most of the Israelite teachers have concluded that Reuben, who is the firstborn son of Jacob through Leah, who should have had the blessing and was disqualified, is aligned with the country of France. And so it was that Reuben had to give up his firstborn birthright portion to Ephraim, who would be the firstborn son placed in the position of the firstborn at the appropriate time. Now, this was a legal transaction. It was for cents on the acre and a bargain at twice the price, especially since this area includes the biggest part of the grain-growing sections of the country. And Reuben does camp on the south side of the tabernacle. Louisiana is the only state in the nation that has parishes instead of counties and is the most French of all 50 states. This is a topographical relief map of the U.S., and notice that the thick veil of the Rockies is in the last third of the country. The curtain that was made in there has 50 loops with 50 fasteners in each of the sets of curtains, and there's several sets of them because they're very thick and they had to be attached together. But there are 50 loops and 50 fasteners in each one of the sets of curtains. Now, lesser known than this, there is a place called Vale Creek, Montana, and it's right outside of a little town called Jordan. There is also a Vale, Arizona in the south, and it was last night that I ran this map to see how far it was one from the other. And what I didn't know is that you've got several options there to go on one side or the other, or to zigzag up through the center of that to go from Vale to Vale. Now, behind this curtain is placed the Ark of the Covenant. The Ark itself is constructed of wood and overlaid inside and outside with gold. If any three states in our union are known more for wood and gold than California, Oregon, and Washington, I don't know it. Washington State is said to be ranked second in the nation for timber production, and one of Oregon's nicknames is the Timber State. And all three states were known for gold mining in the early years of the nation's history. Other information sources stopped here with this and don't say anything else about any of the correlations that we're finding. But I thought that if the pattern of this thing holds true, that there should be at least a few more details and landmarks and something related to the items in the Ark of the Covenant. At the very least, there should be something similar to the cherubim and some indication of the mercy seat. Now, Los Angeles on the south side is obviously very well placed, but after that I drew a blank and I looked again at the map and I wondered if the covering angels might be placed on both ends of the nation's borders. And I finally found that Washington State, at the very tip top of it, actually has a place called Port Angeles. So you have Port Angeles, and Los Angeles have as their median point an interesting midway intersection along Highway 101. The city of Eureka, California, is the westernmost city of more than 25,000 inhabitants in the U.S., and it sits just slightly north of the farthest point to the west of the contiguous United States. Eureka is a word that means I found it. Now, I would later find out that Angel Mountain, California, and Mount Angel, Oregon, were also connected by Interstate 5. They're about 1,067 miles apart. So you have double witnesses on the angels on that side. Now, Eureka is situated between Arcata to the north and Fortuna to the south. There are landmarks in here like Jacoby Forest, Trinity National Forest, the Headwaters Forest Reserve, and last but not least, Kneeland is located just east of Eureka. Humboldt Bay lies on the western edge between Arcata and Fortuna. They're all located in Humboldt County. But a little reminder that Father is hooked on phonics, and it certainly seems providential that Kneeland would be located not only in Humboldt County, but pretty much dead center between the cherubim and near cities with distinctive names connected to the Ark. Now, the mercy seat was the covering or the box top for the Ark, so I thought it might be considered one piece of furniture, but it's actually two separate pieces, and I spent quite a bit of time after I found the other things puzzling about the mercy seat, and I was kind of confused why all the grape vineyards were located in the area where the Holy of Holies was. It seemed to me like if the drink offerings were handled in the outer court area, it didn't make any sense why the wine would be in the inner chamber area. So I asked Father, I said, what's missing in regards to the mercy seat? I pondered over it. Well, no, I didn't. I was kind of obsessed for about 2 weeks. So I started putting it all together, and I looked at the maps again, and I finally got it when Father said, look at Redding and Merced. Well, it's right there. And Sacramento is right between them as the seat of government. And then I finally understood the wine and the grapes being there. I remembered that the main thing that the high priest did when he came into the Holy of Holies was to sprinkle blood on the mercy seat. And I heard this fragment of scripture that says, the blood of grapes. When I looked it up, I was pretty amazed. Genesis 49:11, well, there's 9:11 again, says, of Shiloh, to whom the gathering of the people be, he ties his foal to the vine and his donkey's colt to the choice vine. He washes his garments in wine and his robes in the blood of grapes. Genesis chapter 49 is entirely about Jacob Israel blessing his sons and telling them what will happen to them in the latter days. So this is why most of the nation's grapes had to be here instead of elsewhere. This is California wine country. Now, I decided I would keep on looking, because if all of those things were there, then the three items in the Ark of the Covenant would have to be there too. Now, I remember hearing some Superman talk about A-Rod, Aaron Rodgers, as a sign, and Aaron Rodgers' birthplace and hometown is Chico, California, and it is in the heart of the almond-producing area. Chico is located about 200 miles southeast of Eureka. I discovered that the almond-producing area, according to one source, lay in the valley just west of the Sierra Nevada mountain range, which runs almost like a rod from just north of Chico, California, down to around Bakersfield. If Aaron's rod fit into the equation, then something correlating to the pot of manna and the tables of stone must also be lying around here somewhere between the angels. Not knowing much about the manna, I was confused for days why I couldn't seem to locate one thing that remotely stood out as being significant. And one day I thought, well, okay, manna is the English word, so what does manna mean in the Hebrew? It is man, Strong's, H4478, and it simply means, what is it? And so there wasn't any help there. But in Exodus 16:31, it says this about manna. And the house of Israel called the name thereof manna, and it was like coriander seed, white, and the taste of it was like wafers made with honey. I checked that reference, and there it was. It was hidden in the coriander. The Hebrew word for coriander in the Strong's H1407 is gad. The meaning is usually said to be a troop, but another meaning related to that is fortune. And there is Fortuna right south of I Found It in Arcata, hidden in sight, right in plain view. And I realized that the hidden manna from heaven is only mentioned as hidden one time in Revelation 2:17. He who has an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches. To him who overcomes, I will give some of the hidden manna. I'm clicking through mine and they're not coming up here. Okay. Coriander seed comes from the cilantro plant. And California is the main producer of such plants in the United States. It's in the produce growing regions of the San Joaquin Valley, which incidentally means established by God. And that Spanish name, Joaquin, has its root in the name of Jacob. Now, if you'll notice the cilantro roots, they kind of curl up and look like a ram's horn. And they have said that cilantro actually has kind of a soapy taste to some people, like washing your mouth out with soap. So if that speaks to you, okay. Now, the last item in the ark would be the tablets of stone. And I was looking for, obviously, you know, something like they have in England. You know, where are all these stones here, right? Some visible geographical structure, and I didn't find it. And I think we've all made the assumption that sometime or another that the tables of stone were just carved out of plain granite up on Mount Sinai, and paintings and drawings, you know, the stone tablets and the Ten Commandments and Moses, you know, coming down with these things. And I couldn't find anything. And I called my niece and we were talking about it, and I said, help me out here. And she goes, well, what were they made out of? And I said, well, granite or old stone or something. She said, could they have been made out of something else? Never occurred to me. Okay? So her question took us down a path that would lead to some really amazing coincidences. Okay. In Exodus 24:10, as well as Ezekiel 10:1, mention is made of the throne of God and also the pavement underneath it. In both places, this foundation stone is likened unto sapphire. Exodus 24:9-10. Then went up Moses and Aaron, Nadab and Abihu, and 70 of the elders of Israel, and they saw the God of Israel, and there was under his feet, as it were, a paved work of sapphire stone, and as it were, the body of heaven in his clearness. Ezekiel 10:1 said, "Then I looked, and behold, in the expanse that was over the heads of the cherubim, something like a sapphire stone in appearance resembling a throne appeared above them." And there is the best picture that I could find that looked similar to this. Now, initially, our search led us to research regular sapphire until we discovered that there are many commentaries and Torah scholars that believe that this brilliant blue stone from the throne's pavement or foundation is thought to be lapis lazuli. Now, one of the components of lapis is lazurite. The Spanish and French root word for blue is taken from the word azure. Notice that the word which means light, is contained in that root, and also laser, U-S. It contains the same root word hidden in this name. And because of the numerous coincidences in the etymology and the blue symbolism, I'm pretty convinced now that this lapis is the stone that they're referring to. Now, this stone is also universally considered by almost all other religions to be the stone of heaven. The white streaks that are in it look like clouds, and the gold flecks of pyrite that are in it, they twinkle just like little stars. And since white is symbolic of purity and gold of divinity and truth, would not the divine law also be laced with these same things? Since we got the material possibly wrong, we might also be mistaken about the shape of the tables as well. The Hebrew word for tables that is used in referring to the stone tablets of the law is Strong's 3871 luap, which means board, slab, plate. To the best of my knowledge, it is a transliteration, not a translation. The other usage of the word tables is Strong 7979, which is a word called shulchan, which actually means like a dining table or a flat surface on which to put things. These words aren't even remotely similar in definition or sound or spelling or meaning. Torah scholars have said that the tables of the law are actually called luchot habarit, which literally means cubes of the covenant. Now, while the word tablet or tables is not necessarily an incorrect transliteration in the King James, it is far less accurate. A cube describes dimension and volume, whereas the term tablet does not. And I was pretty uncertain of this and the first time I gave it, but God, in His providence, placed Mark Eaton at the same meeting in 2012, and he was speaking about the law, specifically in reference to the ark, and talked about how the law was voluminous and carrying with it the idea of being full of something and not just a bunch of random rules written down. Anyway, these literally means cubes of the covenant. So this is a different idea altogether here than what we have known previous to this. Now, two cubes fit better in the ark, which is a rectangular shape, than just laying two flat tables down. So if you have two cubes sitting side by side in there, those cubes wouldn't have had to be very big. Okay. I also found out that 6 by 6 by 6 is a measured cube. And when you have that, you have a total of 216, which Ron told us last night. But I found that out the day before yesterday afternoon, and I didn't know what he was going to be talking about. But anyway, that's our double portion of love. And when James asked me to come and share this with you, I wanted some visuals. So about a month ago, it occurred to me that maybe I could find a real lapis lazuli stone to share with you. But in my search for a nice big piece, I ran across a place that sold lapis lazuli beads, shaped like cubes. So I tried to order some. It turned out that they were in China and they couldn't guarantee them to arrive on time. So the other place that had some, that was in America, thank you, Father, for Etsy, had some 4 millimeter sizes, but they were really, really tiny. And the 9mm size exceeded my budget, plus she didn't have 300 of them anyway that I figured that I would need for here. So what they did have plenty of was, wait for it, 6mm cube-shaped genuine lapis lazuli beads. So, I spent one afternoon last week personally attaching each one of these beads onto 300 silver safety pins one afternoon last week. There should be enough for everybody to have one bead on one pin. So if you'll see Dave at that door on your way out, he will be happy to give each person one. If I've got any left over, then we'll talk. So anyway, he will give you those. Now, this thing is called a tefillin, and that's the thing that the Jewish people use to bind on the forehead and on the right arm. Those are shaped like cubes. And let's face it, the dimensions of the Holy of Holies is a 10 by 10 by 10 cube. It's cubes, people. Maybe God really did play dice with the universe. You reckon? Okay. He's hooked on phonics. So it's cubits. I'm thinking that we're on the right track with cubes. Okay. And I'm going to zip through some of these right quick because we're running short on time. Okay. Now, there are other considerations. I'm on 48 now. There are other considerations that prove that the color blue is always associated with the law. The priest's ephod was constructed out of blue. That's 48. Second, there was a command to the children of Israel that shows us that blue is representative of the law. He said, speak to the children of Israel, bid them that they make fringes in the border of their garments throughout the generations, and that they put the fringe on the borders of the ribbon of blue. Now that's called a tallit, and that's pretty much why that it has the blue in there. We can't go into all of the details now. There is a small detail missing from the woman who is called Mystery Babylon. He carried me away in the spirit into the wilderness. I saw a woman sit upon a scarlet-colored beast full of names and blasphemy, having 7 heads and 10 horns. The woman was arrayed in purple and scarlet color, decked with gold and precious stones and pearls, having a golden cup in her hand full of abominations and filthiness of her fornication. Upon her forehead was the name written, Mystery Babylon the Great, Mother of Harlots and Abominations of the Earth. So we've got all the colors except what? Blue. And then we have this little gathering of people. And I don't think I need to say anything else about that. You know who they are and where they gather. And there is no blue there either. We'll talk about some other things related to that later if we have time. Slide 52 shows us a picture of our boys in blue. These are law enforcement officers, also known as Leo. Leo is the constellation that is in the star that represents the tribe of Judah that was supposed to be responsible for the law. So we have a tie between the Judah, Leo, and the boys of blue in these things here. Okay, now I have given you a pretty long discourse. I'm on 54 now, regarding all of the tables of stone and the blue and all of that kind of stuff. But I bet you forgot where we might find them, and you'll need to see this little guy right here. In researching where the lapis lazuli might be mined, we found that there are only two places in the entire United States where this stone can be found. One is in Colorado. The other one is just outside of the Los Angeles area near San Bernardino. It's in the San Gabriel Mountains near a place called Cascade Canyon. Isaiah 30:25 says, and there shall be upon every high mountain and upon every high hill rivers and streams of water in the day of the great slaughter when the towers fall. That is the place of the only working lapis lazuli mine in the nation, and it is called Big Horn Mine. We'll talk about the rest of it in just a few minutes. Then let's take a break and we'll be back.